All right, so we are on lesson 9, focusing on chapters 32 through 34. So not a ton of text, but still a little bit more than we're going to be able to read the whole thing in class. And I want to set the scene for this. So we have the people of Israel. They've now escaped from Egypt by the mighty power of God through the plagues. They've gone through the Red Sea. And then they come out the other side of the Red Sea. And does anybody remember exactly how long it took them before they started complaining?
3 days.
3 days. Now, what were they complaining about?
Water
to start off, and I'm going to be pretty lenient. I understand the need for water in the middle of the wilderness with about 2 million people with you. But at any rate, what happens then is God reveals that he has not left them. He's with them, and he's going to provide for them. He's going to take care of them. All right, so they are on their way. Where are they on their way to? What did you say, Molly? Was that what you were going to say? Mount Sinai? What were you? No? You have good news. Both were correct. There's just a... They're going to Mount Sinai first, but they're headed to the promised land. That's where they're headed, right? But God has told Moses, bring them to Mount Sinai first. So they're coming to Mount Sinai, and why do they need to get to Mount Sinai?
It's for God.
To get the fear of God in them. Yes, let me come back to that. They need to know what God wants, right? And there's another thing that's going on there, and it goes along with get the fear of God in them, and that is they're going to Mount Sinai to meet God. Remember, God tells Moses in Exodus chapter 19, have the people get ready because, here again, in 3 days, they're going to meet me. And what was it like to meet God at Mount Sinai? What'd that look like? Fearful, yes. That's why. Okay, so there's thunder, there's lightning, the mountain is shaking, there's flames on top, a pillar of smoke that is billowing up. There's the command that says, don't you dare touch this, or else... At first it's, or else you guys will have to kill whoever touches it. But then God calls Moses up. Moses goes up and God says, go down and tell them not to go and touch the mountain, or else I will break forth. I will come out against them. And then they hear the mighty voice of God, give them the Ten Commandments. And when the people hear that, what do they say about that whole situation, about God speaking to them? Never again, or else we will die. Okay. Now, that was just the Ten Commandments. There's still more commandments to get. And so Moses is going to go up to the top of Mount Sinai, and he is going to receive more of the commandments. Now, he's already received some of them, but when we get to Exodus chapter 24, this is the end of where we were looking last time. God again is calling Moses up. What's happened in between here, in Exodus, totally lost my train of thought. I think at Exodus 23:22 was where the 70 elders have gone up, and they have, from a distance, they have witnessed God's glory, and they've had this shared meal with him, and then God calls on Moses to go up, which would be in chapter 24. All right, so chapter 24, and starting in verse 12, it says, now the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction. So Moses arose with Joshua his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, wait here for us until we return to you, and behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud, and to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. So Moses goes back up, and everybody down below still sees, okay, Moses has gone up the mountain of death, and it is still the mountain of death because it is still a billowing fire on top, right? All right, how long is Moses up there? 40 days. Joshua is somewhere nearby. It seems to me that he is not all the way up to the top, but he is not down in the camp either. I can't tell you where in between he is.
Not in the 70 either?
He is not with the 70. I'm sorry, what's your question?
Where the whole body is, and then the 70 came apart. What are you running?
I think the 70 are still there with the people now, because they've just been told, if you have any issues, here's who you have to resolve it. I'm assuming that means that they're back with the camp. Well, we know that's true with Joshua, yes. And that's the question with the hearing the people is whether he hears them the whole time or whether he hears them on their way down. And I was thinking about that as I was reading it. Okay, so we get to Exodus chapter 32, and somebody read verse 1 for me. Okay, so we're going to get into question number two here in a second, but we're still on question number one. We're looking at the scene. We're looking at what it looked like. And basically, what are the people worried about with Moses? He's dead. Is that a completely unreasonable thing to be worried about at this point? No, because one thing we know about God is he's really good at killing people. That's what we have seen about God in Exodus. And then we've seen that Moses has gone up into a fire and he hasn't come down for 40 days. At some point, you wonder. So what do they ask for? We want an idol. We want a God who will lead us. And so my question is, really the focus of question number one, as a result of all of this scene, do you think it was reasonable for the people to be worried about Moses and to make the request they did? That question is now wrong. Make the request they did to Aaron. Sorry. Yeah, yes and no. That's just a profoundly unhelpful answer. Right.
No, it's because they didn't trust in God to maintain his leadership.
So why would they be making an idol? Why would they be calling for another God?
They need something visible.
Gary?
They've spent 400 and some odd years in Egypt where there are all kinds of these things down there. And the Egyptians contributed so much to those gods.
Yeah. Okay, so why is it completely unreasonable, Bonnie?
Well, if they reasoned that God just killed Moses, they were then violating the command that God himself had spoken to.
Most ridiculous thing to do. They know the commandments. They know it is from God. They have heard God say, I'm jealous. You shall have no other gods before me. You will have no graven images. And they look up and they say, he's terrifying. We should make a graven image. That was the mindset that went through their minds. And there's a part of us that can understand what's going on. You can understand, where's Moses? And they really need Moses, because without Moses, how are they going to talk to God? They don't have a way. They don't have an access to him. They just made it to where, Moses, you go talk to God. God talks to you. That's it.
They want to go talk to an idol now.
So now they need an idol. So, okay, number two, what specifically then did the people ask to do for them? What specifically did the people ask Aaron? See, I got it right in that question. To do for them. Specifically now, what did they ask? Make us gods. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so that gets into a question. So then what does Aaron say that he's done? So he takes from them all this gold, right? And he fashions a golden calf. And he gets this calf up there and says, tomorrow's going to be a feast. But what does he say it's going to be a feast to? And it's very specific. Remember, when you're looking in the Old Testament, you see Lord and it's all caps. What's that mean? This is Jehovah. This is Yahweh. This is God's name. Very specific. So I don't know exactly what the people are asking. I don't know if they're asking for a different God. But I know what Aaron's saying is, this is the God. So then when the people see the golden calf and the next day, what do they do? Because that's the thing you do. And so it's just this emotionless, this is what we've got to do. I guess we'll go make a sacrifice. No, this is, they put all of their heart, they put all of their might into worshiping this God. All right, meanwhile, Moses is up on top of the mountain with fire. So are you asking?
Visible representation of God, but not that this goal is the God.
I have no idea. I really don't know if that's how they were thinking that would go. I don't think, I mean, it's just the way I perceive it. I don't think the people thought of their idols as literally their gods, but more like their God on a leash. It's like, if I have this, he has to follow me. He has to do what I say to do. Yeah,
Dennis.
Yeah. And it's not surprising that they picked a calf, because that does very much go back to what Egypt was doing. Egypt considered cows to be sacred. They would mummify them and have their own cow deity. Dennis.
One of the thoughts I had on that was, they think Moses is dead. He was their worshiping God.
Right. It needed to be something they had more access to, more control over. Yes. I think that's a certainty. That's, I don't know about totally the mindset, but that's the concept of an idol. And I'm mindful of, and I'll get you there in a second, I'm mindful of the fact that Aaron and the 70 elders, they had just had a meal witnessing God from a distance, and now they thought this was sufficient. That's mind-boggling to me. Now, you can't say that. You were good up to that point. Up to that point, you were bringing stuff up that's right where we're at. Then you skipped a bit. You can't skip a bit. But yes, okay, so they're not struck down right away. But God's not unaware. God's up there with Moses. They're getting the law worked out, written down. And so then what does God say about the people's actions? Looking at verses 7 through 10 specifically. He sees them doing this. What does he think? He is not happy, and that is an understatement. He starts off with, they have corrupted themselves. Right? They quickly turned aside from what I've commanded them. He describes the actions, because Moses isn't down there, so Moses doesn't know what they're doing. And he says, they are an obstinate, they're stiff-necked, stubborn. He sees they're not going to change. After everything they have experienced and everything they have seen, they've immediately broken the commandment. It's one thing before all of this, when they were back in Egypt and they're upset at Moses because he's just made their life harder. They haven't seen the power of God yet. It's another thing when you're starting off in the journey and they're thinking, well, maybe God's out here to destroy us. But he has been providing for them. He's been taking care of them. He's given them the law. They have no excuse of ignorance. They have no excuse. And he says, these people are not going to change. Step aside, Moses. And this is interesting to me, because he tells Moses, let me alone. Which makes me wonder, what could Moses have done? How do you stop God? His plan is to destroy all the people and do what? I'm going to make Moses, I'm going to make you a great nation. Why is he going to do that to Moses? I mean, not like that's a negative thing, but why is he going to make a great nation out of Moses instead of say, Moses, you're just going to have a great life now? I still have promises I have to keep. I still have promises that this land is going to be your people's land because I made a promise to Abraham, and I'm just going to funnel it through you, Moses. That's what's going to happen. So from Moses' perspective, who is God going to destroy? That's an incredibly hard question for you to answer. I have a very specific answer in my mind. Yes, he's going to destroy God's own people, but what kind of relationship did Moses have with those people? Say, like, I don't know, the second time when they have no water. What does Moses say to God about them they're about to do? They're about to kill me. Here are the people who are going to kill me, given a chance, given an opportunity. And God's saying, I'm going to do it to them. And I'm going to make you great. So what's Moses do? Which I think is an amazing, amazing thing. Moses stands to gain everything here. Saved his life. He stands to be made the new Abraham. And he instead tells God, don't kill them. And what is his reasoning? Which, by the way, perfectly fine to reason with God. What does Moses reason with him? Okay, one, because the people of Egypt are going to say, you brought them out, they're here just to kill them. What's the real argument there? Yeah, it's that the Egyptians are right, and God, you are not really nice. You're not good. And the world's going to know that you're not a good God. All right, any other arguments in there? Yeah, remember the promises. Remember that they're your people. What argument does he not make? That one's, by the way, huge. I mean, there's a whole bunch of arguments he didn't make, but the people don't deserve to die. God, this isn't that big of a deal. They're just, you say they're worshiping a calf. We can go correct this. No, he doesn't say the people don't deserve this. The people aren't worthy of it. That's not his argument at all, and he wouldn't have had much of an argument to make. All right, so Moses now is coming down with the two tablets of stone that have the law on them, written by God. And as he's going, he somewhere in here meets Joshua. And what does Joshua say he hears? I think there's a war going on at camp. And Moses says, I don't think that's a war. What does Moses hear? Yeah, he says, that's not the cry of victory. And that's not the cry of defeat. What I hear is singing. And so finally he comes into view of the camp, sees what they are doing, sees how they are doing it, and how does Moses respond? So we're on to number 5. How does he react when he finally sees this for himself? He's got an intense anger at this point. I think there's a difference between being told what's going on and seeing and hearing what's going on. Moses changes here because he was being an interceder, and now he's going to do something different. First, he's going to go to Aaron. And who does Aaron blame for this sin? We start off with the people. You know the people. They're not controllable. They demanded it. What was I going to do? All right. And then, Barry. Yeah, I put, just boom. I mean, it must be from God, right? I have no idea if that's accurate or not. I don't know if he's making it up or not. Would it make a difference? Would it make a difference if he had thrown some gold in and out came a perfectly molded calf? Would that make a difference? Would that suddenly say this is obviously from God? I know people would think that, but it would not make a difference. It was not what God asked to do. All right, so is Moses satisfied with that answer? Like, oh, Aaron, you're off the hook. Boy, I do know about these people. Like, no. It says in verse, let's see, turn my page. And verse 25, now when Moses saw the people were out of control, for Aaron had let them get out of control to be a derision among their enemies. It was Aaron had let this happen. That's not to make the people absolve that they're innocent, but Aaron has this responsibility of leadership to not do what the people want, but do what is right. And to, when the people come and say, make a God for us, to respond and say, we have a God and we cannot make a God against him. And to appeal to the people, that may or may not make them change, but that's his responsibility. And instead he joined them. He didn't even try. No. There are other times where they're going to try, right? I mean, in the next quarter, when Jim starts teaching, he's going to be looking at the start off with the spies. Moses and Aaron are going to stand before the people and say, don't do this. Now, it's not going to change what they do. But Moses and Aaron did what they were supposed to do. And here, Aaron does not. All right. So what does Moses do with the golden calf? He throws it in the fire, breaks it down, grinds it up, puts it in the water, and says, now drink. This is your sin. You guys have to own it. You have to put it, take it in. Now, I don't have a question for this, but what does Moses do next? Yeah, he starts off and he says, all right, you guys need to make a decision now. Who's on God's side? How should the people have responded to that? This is an additional baffling thing to me. Why are the people worshiping the golden calf? Because Moses is gone. Moses says, who's on the Lord's side? Moses isn't gone anymore. And the people don't join him. Only the Levites join him. And with the Levites, he then says, all right, take a sword and go through from the camp, from this side to that side. And who does he tell them to kill? Brother, companion, neighbor. I don't think he's literally saying, go find your brother, kill them, then find your friend and kill them, and then find your neighbor and kill them. Because that might be a problem, because some of them are carrying swords doing the work, you know, saying, oh, whoops, you are my neighbor, and that's a problem. I think what he's saying is, you go through there and you enact the judgment of God, and if you see somebody who is your friend, you don't stop. And if you see somebody who's a relative, you don't stop, because this is the judgment of God and they have made their choice. They've taken their action. And so now then 3,000 people are killed as a result of that. Okay. So then Moses says he's going to go back up to the top of the mountain. What's he going to attempt to do? He's going to attempt to make atonement. Why attempt?
Because he's not sure if he can convince God.
Why not?
God's angry.
Well, number one, God is angry. All right. Let's say you'd stolen something. Let's say the whole people, this is what they decided to do. Moses isn't here. Everybody for themselves, go loot his camp. Now that, so they all go into Moses' camp and they all take his stuff, right? Could Moses have gone up to the mountain and made atonement for the people? I'll give you a hint. Okay, good, you caught it. Yeah, yeah. What's the difference between stealing and worshiping another god? Under the law. No, I think there's a pretty big difference. Oh, yes, it's wrong either way, but the consequence. So if you steal, you have to give back double, or if you can't, you have to give back five times as much. If you worship another god, what's the consequence? Death. Moses is saying, I'm going to attempt to make atonement for you, because under the law, there is no atonement to be had. You have done something that is punishable by death, and we're not allowed to just give God some money and redeem you that way. I don't know what can be done, but it's the whole nation. How are we going to resolve this? So he goes up and he tries to make atonement to God. And he says to God, if you won't forgive them, do what?
Kill me.
Blot me out. Take me out of your book. How's God respond to that? Moses, that's not how it works. Like, that's the one who's going to be punished is the one who has done the sin, which is interesting. Keep that in mind. That's the rule that he has made. And he says in verse 33, I will blot him out of my book, which I've asked the thought question or the opinion question in number 6 at the end. What do you think the book is that he is referencing when he says, I will take you out of my book? It's the book of life. I'm pretty sure that's what he's talking about. We see it in the Old Testament, the book of Psalms. We just saw it in Philippians. In Philippians, it talks about the two women and that they are in the book of life. What does it mean to be in the book of life? Think about this context. Think about that context. What's that mean?
Have salvation.
I guess that's a simplified way of saying it. Yeah, it means this is one of mine. These are the one of the ones that I am with, that I am going to take care of. But instead he's saying, if they've sinned, I'm taking them out of the book. So they're no longer protected by me. They're no longer on my side, Rob.
Well, just the way I understood it is, when he speaks to the citizenship, you know, getting back in the line, being, you know, part of that citizen in that colony, your name is in that book.
Yeah, especially in Philippians. I mean, and also comes up many times in the book of Revelation. So look back at the end of Exodus 32.
Make sure you're in the book of life.
By doing what God wants you to do, maintain your relationship with him. All right, so picking up in verse 31, it says, then Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has committed a great sin, and they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will, forgive their sin, and if not, please blot them out from your book. Please blot me out from your book, which you have written. And the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, leave the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin. And the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. Now, it doesn't explain to us in verse 35 when or how God did this, but what has God said to Moses was in their future. This is what it means to store up wrath for the day of wrath. In Romans chapter 2 and verse 5, it talks about how their unrepentant hearts, their stubbornness. He's saying, you are storing up wrath. What it means is, right now, God has declared, my judgment is against you, but you don't see it yet. The sentence has been made, but there's going to be a later time when it is actually enacted. And so they have wrath stored up. And it's just a matter of time when God is going to unleash it. I suspect that it is in reference to the events that are going to happen during the wandering that Jim is going to talk about at the beginning of next year. All right, so in chapter 33 then, God tells Moses, depart, go up from here. But did anybody notice what they didn't do at this point? They don't go anywhere. This is not them leaving Mount Sinai. They're still at Mount Sinai for the next several chapters. They're not going to leave until the book of Numbers. So they're still here, but this is where God is saying, get up, go. The promise is still there. You guys can still go to the promised land despite this. Head that direction. But what has changed? Yeah. Get up and go. But I'm not going to be with you. Why not?
You're stiff-necked people.
You're stiff-necked. And that's a bad thing with me. I might destroy you guys on the spot. So, no. Now, keep in mind, you have to take the whole book into context. That's not the end of the story. He has said, I'm going to send somebody. I'm going to send an angel in front of you. You're still going to be victorious, but it's not going to be me. So how do the people respond when they hear this? Yeah, they mourned. So we're on question number 7. What was the sad word the people heard which caused them to mourn? And it was, God's not going to be with you anymore. And you guys are really stiff-necked, obstinate. So how do the people then change?
They did.
They took off all their ornaments. What ornaments? You have a vision of them like a Christmas tree? where did their ornaments come from? God had looted the Egyptians, told them, take their gold, take their silver. They're wearing it. They're out in the middle of the wilderness, and they're wearing this. Now, what had they done with some of this?
Turned it into a
golden calf. And so now God has told them, and they, out of their heart, because they are mourning, and that is part of why they're doing this, but it also, God had instructed them, don't wear that anymore. So now the people of Israel who were going around, I have old visions of Mr. T, you know, walking through the wilderness with all these chains around them, I don't know why you do that, but now they've taken them off. It says from Mount Horeb, from Mount Sinai on, they're not wearing these anymore. So they have stopped doing that. All right. So, in a continued relationship with God, Moses still needs to speak to God, but right now he's only speaking to God by going up to the top of the mountain. They're not going to stay at the mountain. So where is Moses going to speak to God once they leave the mountain? It's called the Tent of Meeting, which everything I look at, I think he's talking about the tabernacle. He's talking about the tabernacle that we're going to talk about next week, because that is a huge chunk of the book of Exodus. He's going to first go through, and that's what we've skipped from chapter 25 up to chapter 32, instructions on how to build the tabernacle. That's what we get afterwards in chapter 35 following. Now that you have the instructions, actually build the tabernacle, and then chapter 40 ends with the tabernacle having been built. And in there, it's called the Tent of Meeting. And so this is now the place where Moses is going to meet with God. It is a little different because later on in Numbers, the tabernacle is going to find its place in the center of the people. There's going to be a division between the tabernacle and the people, and that's going to be the Levites. But it's in the center. Right now, in Exodus 33, where is the Tent of Meeting placed? Outside the camp. Remember, we've got this distance. God's not going to be in your presence, or else he will smite you all. He will kill you all because you're so obstinate. All right, so Moses then would go out to the Tent of Meeting to speak to God. As he's on his way, what would the people do? They stand at their doorway and they watch and they wait. So Moses gets to the Tent of Meeting. What does God do? He descends down. And so now we have the cloud coming down onto the Tent of Meeting. What significance does that have then for the people? When Moses comes out and says, here's what you need to do, what's that tell you? He spoke with God. This is a confirmation of the word. You got confirmation of the word in Mount Sinai with God speaking. You got confirmation of the word with God showing himself in the tent. All right. And so while the tent is there with Moses and the cloud, what do the people do then? For that whole time, they're now going to fall down and worship. All right, so then Moses comes out, and it says that Joshua then at that point guards the Tent of Meeting whenever Moses isn't in there. All right, now, remember, what happened to the two tablets of stone that had the law on them? They were shattered. One of the great, great losses of humanity, to have the handwriting of God, and now it's been shattered. So God calls Moses back up the mountain. And he says, first, I want you to cut up some stones and bring them with you. Where's Moses at? He's at the bottom. What does Moses take with him to climb a mountain? Tablets of stone. Any of you climb a mountain and say, you know what I really want to carry right now? Two tablets of stone. I don't know how big they were, but I've never wanted to pack tablets of stone. But he does that because God tells him to. So he goes up, and God is going to once again give the law his writing. So the great loss is going to be replaced. And while he's up there, Moses makes a request. And what's his request? Actually makes a few requests. Yeah, he says, I want to see your glory. I want to see you. Which, by the way, is significant because he's already seen God, right? He was with the 70 when God was over on Mount Sinai in a distance. But Moses is saying, I didn't really see you. That wasn't close enough. I really want to know who you are. And I really want you to still come with us. Remember, God had said, I'm not going to come with you. It's going to be an angel. But now Moses is pleading, don't abandon us. Yeah. I can make an attempt. So when he says that he spoke to Moses face to face, I don't believe he is saying, here's God's face, here's Moses' face. Yes, so he is talking about the fact that it is a conversation that is occurring between them, as opposed to, how does God often speak to people? Well, to us, it's through scripture, or to, say, like a prophet, through dreams, through visions, through this distance way, but here's just like a conversation. Something where Moses is still saying, I still can't see you, but he can just talk. And God just talks right back. And they're in this close relationship, right? Very special. I mean, God's saying, that's something I don't do with everybody. Yeah, Sean.
You know, another thought, when we go back to Abraham. Mm-hmm. There is some sort of physical representation, but it's not the glory of God.
Right.
So it could be a physical representation, but it is definitely not the glory of God, because that happens later, and it's not the full glory of God that
right, and there are many times where people, like when Jacob is wrestling and it's like, who are you? And you don't know until later, right? And so whatever the situation is, when Moses is in the situation, he knows, I still haven't seen God. So now he's saying, I would like to actually see you. I want to see you in all of your might, all of your glory. And God replies, no, you will die. Which, by the way, makes something that the New Testament promises amazing. Because in the Beatitudes, we're told we can see God. Or at the end of the book of Revelation, in Revelation chapter 22, verse 3 through 4, when it gives us this great scene of victory and the scene of heaven, it says, we will see the face of God. There's a day, there's a time coming when we are going to change, and we're going to be able to do what Moses could not do right here. All right, so God says, you can't see me, but I'll let you see like a shadow, a remnant of me. So you're going to go and you're going to stand up in the rocks and I'm going to cover you with my hand, which makes me think God's big. And then I'm going to pass by and then I'll remove my hand and you will see my backside. All right. So this is what happens. And as God is going by to show him his glory, there's this announcement, this proclamation as God is going by. This is God saying, Moses, here I am. And forget about the visual aspects of it. What gets told to us in detail is the declaration. This is who God is. And who is God then? What does God want us to know about who he is? Bonnie? So when God wants to be known and wants to declare himself, he starts off, he says, Lord, Lord God, I am the mighty one. I am the ultimate God. And then he says, and I am compassionate. and I am forgiving, and I have loving kindness for thousands, not just a few, but for a large number of people, and I am judging. And so he describes himself in this way that we might look at as contradicting, but he's complex. He is both merciful and exacting. He demands justice, and he will punish. And he says even to multiple generations, declaring that sin has a horrible consequence, that the consequences of it spread, and that God is long-lasting and will not forget. So this is the way that God is described. Yep, go ahead. Right.
But I think what you said is how I understand it too. It's not that I'm going to hold the third and fourth generation accountable for that sin, but the consequences of the sin that person committed is going to now drag out.
Yeah, the consequence, people that are not guilty sometimes pay the price for other sins. And then when you sin, it impacts yourself. It impacts your children. It impacts your grandchildren. It can impact your great-grandchildren. It is awful, and I'm the one who has to punish them. Barry. And it's not like God wants to be known as the God of just absolute judgment. I mean, that's not where he starts off. His emphasis is on his compassion. Okay, I'm going to run out of time, so I have to say the next things really quickly. So what happens after that is Moses comes down from the mountain, and guess what? He's shining and glowing, and everybody's terrified of him. And this goes back to the cloud at the tent of meeting. From then on, whenever Moses spoke to the people, after speaking to God, they could see it. They could see it on his face that he was in the presence of God. Afterwards, he would veil his face, and so they could not see it. And Paul finds that fascinating. In 2 Corinthians 3, you can read about Paul coming back saying, that means a whole lot. You know what it meant? The old law was going to go away. Who would have got that? What I find interesting is this. After this, they don't have to have a glowing-faced person when they're reading the law of Moses. It was confirmed then, and that was sufficient. In the same way, the miracles of the apostles and the prophets in the New Testament confirmed the word, and we didn't need it afterwards. It was already established to be from God. All right, so next week we will finish the book of Exodus, and then we're going to have a few more weeks after that to do Leviticus and Numbers. So lesson 10 for next week. Thank you.